Monster Man, episode 280. My Favorite Monster with Eleanor Hingley.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode. This is one of My Favorite Monster, the infrequent series of episodes where I talk to game creators about, well, their favorite monster, like it says in the title. But before we do that, I have some business to take care of. I've got to thank some new patrons. Yes, these are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 per month to help support the show. And if, like today's patrons, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take an in-depth look at the Deities and Demigods supplement and how to use it and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. So thank you very much to Dominic and Questionable Judgment. Your support means a lot to me, even if you think it's a questionable decision. All right, my guest today is Eleanor Hingley. Eleanor has written adventures for DM's Guild anthologies like Uncaged Anthology Volume 2, which you'll recall we talked about on an earlier special episode, and Book of Seasons Equinoxes, with another, Through the Veil, Tales of the Feywild, coming out this year. She's also written for Aegean, Voidheart Symphony, and the 40K role-playing game Wrath and Glory, and her interactive fiction has been featured in Sub-Q magazine. Eleanor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. As our listeners who have heard previous My Favorite Monster episodes will know, what I've asked you to do is choose a monster. I say favorite, but it could really just be the one that you want to talk about on the show. And when I asked you, you decided you wanted to talk about Melusine. And I'm very interested to find out about that. But before we do that, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in designing role-playing games?
Well, when I was growing up and going through kind of my teenage years, where a lot of other people get involved in role-playing games at that kind of time, there was nothing really in my area. So at the same time, I really loved kind of fantasy literature and all of that kind of stuff. So when I got to university at the University of East Anglia, and there was a role-playing society there called UEA GameSoc, which is fondly remembered by many gamers, I found this kind of amazing community. And for years and years, I sort of played games, I ran games, I wrote settings and things like that. But I never thought that I could be a role-playing game writer and designer. But then the Uncaged Anthology kind of all call for submissions came out, and I thought, oh, I'll just get involved in that, you know, this sounds really cool. I really like it as an idea. This idea of sort of feminist reimaginings of female monsters. So I submitted my sort of pitch to them, and they got so many submissions that ended up going from what was intended to be one volume to four volumes of content. But it really kind of gave me a sort of starting point into the community as a writer and a designer. And it meant that I was able to kind of gain the confidence to actually start writing my own stuff. But it also meant that I had something on my CV that I could kind of, when I submitted work to Cubicle 7, which led to me working on Wrath and Glory, it meant that I had that sort of proof of concept there, almost. I could say, look, I've actually done something within this community. So that's sort of how I got started. And since then, I've sort of tried to get involved in projects where I see them. It's been an incredible journey. It's only been like a couple of years, really, but it's been really exciting.
And you mentioned sort of reimaginings of female monsters, and that of course ties into the monster that you wanted to talk about today, which is Melusine. Now, I think that maybe, you know, unlike some of the other monsters that we've talked about on the show in the past, maybe Melusine is not as familiar to people. She's not as well known as some other kind of monsters from medieval literature, particularly in the English-speaking world. I don't know if that's true in France as much. I think of her as much more kind of a feature of French medieval literature. So let's start by talking about, I mean, who or what is Melusine?
Well, the easy answer to that is that she's a snake woman with bat wings. but she's a fey enchantress or a fey creature in some interpretations, usually associated with that sort of fairy tale world, the idea of a woman who has either been cursed or is by her nature this sort of snake-tailed being. But she is usually depicted as being able to cover that with an illusion, or it only sort of manifesting under certain circumstances, mm-hmm. and appearing to be a beautiful, I don't want to say normal woman, but a human woman, yeah, the rest of the time.
Two legs.
Yes. Yeah, two legs. she's kind of got quite a complicated history. I'm sure you sort of found this when looking into it. There's lots of different interpretations of her, and she occupies this sort of strange space between being kind of a monster and a... I think you described it in the Rusalka episode as a monster and a victim kind of role.
Yeah, that was sort of one of the things that I thought was most interesting about it, because, you know, a lot of the time I feel like modern readers and kind of like fantasy fans in general, we have a strong tendency to make characters who are intended to be uncomplicatedly monstrous sympathetic. Right?
Yes.
I was thinking about this the other day with regard to the Creature from the Black Lagoon, where, you know, everyone reads the Creature from the Black Lagoon as a misunderstood outsider, but that's not really as present in the text as you might imagine. That's Frankenstein. You're thinking of Frankenstein. But in the case of Melusine, I think it maybe is more like she is a little bit more sympathetic. Probably the most famous version of the Melusine story comes from the, I want to say, 14th century French writer Jean d'Arras, and that's where she is explained as an ancestor of a particular French noble family, right? And that's a pretty common trope, like the supernatural ancestor. And yeah, because she's both cursed and she has a fey nature. Like, her mother's a fairy and her father's the king of Scotland. And there's sort of like an iterating version of the fairy curse, because he breaks the mother's magical taboo, so she flees from him. And then the father goes looking for them, and Melusine imprisons her father.
Yes.
And because of this act of like disloyalty, you know, like unfilial behavior, her mother puts a spell on her such that she's going to have snake legs one day of the week.
Yes, absolutely.
And so then this other nobleman falls in love with her, and she says, well, yes, I will marry you, but, you know, one day a week I'm going to go and lock myself up and you can't see me. So, of course, naturally he spies on her. So then she turns into a dragon, gives him two magic rings and flies away. So, like, I feel like there's a lot to unpack here.
Absolutely. It's very complicated legend, that you know, that particular iteration of it, but it's always been kind of complicated in all the different versions of it.
And it feels like a lot of motifs that we have seen in other monsters sort of like being combined into a single story, right? Like a magical bride with a weird taboo, a nobleman meets a fairy maid while he's out hunting, a noble family has a supernatural ancestor. Like, those are all, and she builds castles too. That's kind of like her hobby.
Yes, and like protects a castle as well and flies around it keening when it's knocked down. It's very strange.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Even today, you can still hear Melusine, you know, weeping for her children or whatever. Yeah. And so, like, there's a lot. And I guess this kind of leads into my next question, sort of, you know, maybe we've already answered that, but that is, so what was it that appealed about this figure that made you think, like, oh, that's the monster that I want to include in my scenario? Because you said that you sent them a pitch first, like, you didn't write the whole thing out and then send it in.
No, they asked for pitches for what sort of monster you'd sort of include, partly, I think, to avoid having just an entire book of the same monster. If they did get an entire book's worth of the same monster, then pitching it as that rather than, you know, as a variety.
Well, they nearly did, right? Like, I think as we went over it, there are like six Rusalka scenarios.
Like that,
but they're all completely different. Like, they're not, you know, because all these monsters are so subject to reinterpretation, you can use the same thing. And, you know, particularly because as a monster that doesn't have a standard D&D version, that everyone who started from the same folkloric starting point wound up scenario-wise being quite different from each other. So I'm not saying the scenarios aren't the same, but they're all Rusalkas, and they're all kind of set in pseudo-Eastern Europe, I guess. So when you did that, you chose Melusine. So what was it that appealed to you about this monster?
So I've kind of been fascinated by Melusine ever since I read Marina Warner's From the Beast to the Blonde, because she sort of mentioned in that as one of a kind of number of figures that are drawn from... Well, Marina Warner links them to the Sibyl and the kind of Renaissance reimagining of the Sibyl, well, medieval Renaissance reimagining of the Sibyl, that she left her kind of you know, oracular shrine, and then became this sort of fae woman who lived under a mountain and lured men into her grotto with promises of knowledge. And I read about sort of this sort of set of legends, and Melusine really appealed to me out of those because of the idea that the transgression in the Melusine story is a man breaking his promise, but that is portrayed as being, in some ways, it's kind of seen as the blame is on the woman for having a secret, not the man for not respecting her privacy. And I sort of love the position of all of this sort of storytelling within the idea of kind of gossip circles, like spinning circles of women, where they would tell each other stories. And then those often were sort of seen to include kind of secret and dangerous knowledge that men were not privy to.
Yeah, because that is the sort of the taboo that he breaks, right? Is that he you know, you're supposed to like respect this space to which men are not admitted. Well, indeed, to which nobody is admitted.
Yes.
But he doesn't. But yeah, she's the one who gets punished, and he actually gets rewarded.
Yeah.
You know, she gives him the magic rings before turning into a dragon and flying away. Or sometimes just sprouting wings from her humanoid form. I keep saying dragon because I think probably the most recent thing I read about Melusine was Martin Arnold talks about her in his book about dragons, The Dragon, Fear and Power. And there he suggests that this is a particularly like, you know, she doesn't start off as a dragon-like character, but then she's and in the medieval audience, or to a medieval audience, the dragon is a more probably evil. I mean, it's another example of, you know, modern readers take them and make them sympathetic. Like, we like dragons, but they're evil in medieval things. And sort of he says that this is, he calls it, quote, gynophobic. And he says it's basically this idea that like, oh, women have secrets and those secrets are dangerous and you don't want to know what they are. And, you know, that it's a story about women's secrets, but that it's very much told from a man's perspective, which is interesting. And again, in particular, that her role as a mother to sons is, you know, is really important, right? That she has all these sons, but they're all slightly monstrous. They all have one weird feature. Like, one of them has one real big tooth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, one of them's got a wolf claw coming out of his face, which is, I don't know how I would represent that. But I like the idea of her as kind of a sibyl, right? And that's the idea of moving the kind of magical woman figure from a position within society to one on the fringes of society.
Yes.
Yeah, that she stops being a figure that is in some way bounded, if we're accepting her as a sibyl. You know, sibyls have a weird place in society, but they have a place within society.
It's a very interesting tension. I've always found the tension between the sort of prophesying female figure and the very kind of worldly power of kind of rulership and kingship to be fascinating, because obviously in kind of classical mythology the sibyl is respected as a figure for the most part, but then in medieval and kind of Renaissance literature she does become this destabilizing force in many ways, you know. And obviously you've got the rather on the nose idea of Melusine as a snake woman who has forbidden knowledge and then imparts that to men, which, you know, corrupts them and all of that kind of thing, which obviously would have been very resonant for a medieval audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet the view of that character is still somewhat ambiguous because she's not particularly portrayed as evil other than by her nature. I guess that makes sense. Because the story, I mean, Jean Darras's version of the story is talking about how great her descendants are. Right. I mean, this is the tale of the Lusignan family, and we're supposed to think it's kind of cool that they have a magical ancestor, but just, you know, she's conveniently not around anymore.
Yeah, that idea that she kind of, she does transgress by taking revenge on her father for breaking his promise, but again, that's portrayed as her mistake, and it's kind of, you know, she does have this act of transgression against a male patriarchal figure that is then corrected by the matriarchal figure,
right? Who's corrected by the victim?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Like, her mother is the victim of her father's transgression. But she's the one who punishes Melusine.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it feels like there's, you know, one of the things about sort of successful monsters is either that they have like one very powerful and obvious meaning, or that they have like multiple, that they're adaptable, right?
Yes.
There are a lot of different ways in which one can portray a monster like this one in a game. So like if you're trying to turn this, you know, curious story about the antiquities of the Lusignan family into something interactable, into something that's going to appear in a game, you know, what then do you, you know, how then do you take it and use it?
I think the first thing that sort of was a real challenge with writing this monster, well, writing Melusine as a monster in a typical D&D scenario, is that you can't just have it that she is a bad person and then you stab her in the end, because that is full of uncomfortable implications.
Well, and it also duplicates a character that Melusine recalls from sort of classical mythology is Lamia, right?
Yes.
And Lamia is already a D&D monster.
Yes.
You know, if you want a bad animal lady who was punished by the gods with a monstrous form and just like is bad, well, there's a, or Medusa is, you know, again, who is another, like Lamia, is a, you know, a victimized monster character with animal, indeed snaky features, you know. So even if you did want to take that approach, like there are probably other more resonant monsters that already do that.
Absolutely. So what I found interesting to explore was the idea of Melusine as almost like apart from a political structure, but influential upon it. So she, in other situations, potentially would have been a quest giver, a powerful NPC who had prophesying knowledge. I definitely brought in more of the Sybil aspects of her and mm-hmm. granted her the ability to kind of prophesy over a kingdom. So you can have her as a powerful NPC who stands apart from the standard political structures and can comment upon them,
mm-hmm.
Potentially. So if you do have sort of evil kings or puppet kings, then there are people outside of that political structure, outside of the kingdom, who have an investment in seeing those structures rectified, you know, the kind of corruption within them excised.
Yeah, and that fits in with the idea of her role as kind of an ancestor as well, right? Because, she is, you know, sort of a weirdly maternal figure. You know, she has 10 kids and whatever. And that sort of, that fits in with the sort of matriarchal stereotype, right? Like, your mom wants what's best for you, but that's not the same as what you want.
Yes. And I think actually there is a potential for exploring that idea that mom wants what's best for you, but that might not be the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have her be a more ambiguous figure through using that matriarchal role. You know, I would definitely still, you could have her as being the kind of villainous overlord of a bunch of monsters that you then have to slay. But then again, that feels like it's both too easy and very uncomfortable, shall we say. But having her occupy a more kind of morally ambiguous space where she doesn't understand that what she wants, what she thinks is best, isn't actually going to be the best thing for the kingdom, for her family, for the people around her, could provide some interesting tensions, I think.
Well, and she also has like a good example of a sympathetic villain motivation, which is, even if you do want to use her in a sort of more strictly villainous capacity, she's kind of like, she's sort of nonetheless the product of forces beyond her control. You know, maybe she's gonna, like, you know, return in dragon form and bite you. And, like, it's not like she wants to do it, but the rules are the rules. You know, that's just how it goes. Like, if you didn't want the curse to affect you, you should have read the manual.
Yeah, there's an implication that if you get involved with a fairy lady, then something's going to go wrong at some point.
Which is one of those things that I think is hard to replicate in role-playing games, because role-playing game characters will absolutely be like, oh, there are a bunch of rules? Okay, like, let me write these all down carefully. Now, when you say, like, on a Saturday, like, are we talking about midnight or sunrise? Because player characters in general tend to be much more cautious than fairy tale characters, because unlike fairy tale characters, player characters don't want to come to a bad end.
Yes, they seem to, a lot of the time they want to kind of understandably get the good ending from a scenario. I don't want to say win, because that's a bit mean to role-playing know, players, but they want to kind of do the right things to get the right ending.
I mean, so maybe curiosity is actually one of those motivations that does kind of apply, because it's one of the few that translates between the narrative and the tabletop, because when you know something in character, you also know it out of character.
Yes.
But, you know, like, I think we've discussed this before, this idea that player characters are never lazy, they're never hungry, they're never, you know, everyone spends their gold coins on longswords, they never, like, buy a Coke, because they're never actually thirsty.
I think there are games where you do emphasize more of concepts like dramatic irony, where, you know, the players know something the characters don't, or the characters make suboptimal decisions, but certainly Dungeons and Dragons doesn't really emphasize that style of play.
Well, and because I think traditionally there's been this play culture that punishes on an out of character level those kinds of choices. Like, if you do that stuff, there are some percentage of the player base who are going to think of you as making a mistake, and they're going to call you dumb to your face.
Yes, that discouraged me for a very long time.
and I don't think it's, I don't even necessarily think it's like ill-intentioned, but certainly you get that idea, like, oh, if you die in this dungeon, it's because you're stupid. And I'm like, look, if I'm having fun, how am I stupid?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I play a lot of games like Monster Hearts and things like that that incentivize poor choices in character.
Well, which make a distinction between the player succeeding and the character succeeding, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that you can use kind of curiosity as a way of being like, oh, you went in the room that you weren't supposed to go in. Of course, something bad happened. But then there is a risk that players will feel that that's unfair on some level, because they went and did the thing that the adventure told them to do, and now they're being told off for it by the adventure.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Like, so, which just means that you need to provide, you know, a compelling, like, the husband in the Millie Scene story just is married to her for years and years and years and years and years until finally the pressure of not knowing what's going on in the bathhouse gets to be too much, right? But you might...
Yeah, it's like gender-swapped Bluebeard's Bride, you know?
I mean, yeah, it has a lot of similarities. Well, except there's no murders.
Yeah,
just,
I mean, obviously there's a lot of very... There's a lot of other elements of it that are very, very different, but yes.
Yeah, and it kind of... But, you know, you could get around that problem, I think, by including something that was just a more compelling motivation for the people, like, you know, but no one may enter the bathhouse on a Saturday. Listen, pal, there's a crisis, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we got to find that blue jewel and fast. You know, there's no time to...
Yeah, give them a motivation that that they know in character and out of character overrides their kind of desire to stick by the rules.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, those rules exist to sort of set up a status quo. And then, you know, if you're telling an action-adventure story of some kind, then presumably what you're going to do is violate that status quo somehow.
And good stories are always about disruption of an existing balance. But I think if you don't want to put players in that position, the easy way to do it is to essentially have an NPC make that transgression themselves, and then the players kind of have to clear it up. So the transgression is then not the player's fault, but they still have to deal with the outcome of it, and they still have to kind of deal with the consequences and potentially find a better ending.
I mean, especially if you have a character like Melusine, who is effectively already a magical protector of the realm, right? So we had this magical protector, and then Dum Dum here had to go peek into her bathhouse, and now she's like, now, you know, the taboo has been broken, and so she's fled.
Yeah, I mean, if I may very quickly talk about the adventure I wrote.
Please.
Some spoilers if people are likely to play it and don't want to run it. Basically, I had the king of the land transgress and be the one to transgress, which threw everything out of balance. And then he did that out of a selfish motivation. He basically cursed her to basically become this kind of mind controlling monstrosity so that he could ignore the prophecy that she'd put forward. I did change it quite a lot, I will say. Like, the legend is very different, but that idea was that I wanted to give the players the chance to investigate and try and find out why she was acting the way she was, but also have the male transgressor be someone who could be sort of punished through it, because they do have the option of just going along with it and, like, basically silencing her and kind of agreeing with the king. Obviously that's the not great ending. That's the not very lawful good ending to the whole thing.
But so, yeah, I think that that's interesting, right? The idea that, like, yeah, you sort of, like, we have to get the monster back, right? That's a very much the reverse of the normal scenario structure, which is the problem is that we have a monster, but we would like not to have it.
Yeah.
Whereas what you're describing is, like, well, actually, we had a monster, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, no, is the monster maybe man? Perhaps.
Oh, the real monster.
By that I mean humanity, not like men specifically, though it's a bit anti-patriarchal, you know.
I mean, in fairness, if anyone ever says, like, hey, you can't say man is the real monster, you know, oh, you mean humanity, I refer you to the 1977 Monster Manual, which where they are described under M for men.
Oh, okay. It's in the manual.
It's in the manual. I think that's really interesting, and I think it is a fantastic example of the kind of, like, because there's quite a lot, I think there's a lot of those stories where supernatural beings, maybe monsters not even the right word, supernatural beings occupy this actually quite central space. That, you know, they exist in a sort of relationship with society, and they're bad and dangerous maybe, but they're not just, like, forces assailing society from without. And that's often true of female monsters, right? Do you think that sort of Baba Yaga has a similar, and, like, witches in general.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, or witchety monsters, hags, have a similar role where they're bad and they're dangerous and they're evil, but they're not completely asocial.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the idea of a necessary evil or something that has a role in society and is necessary to that society continuing. So, you know, in real world terms, you have people like midwives or like, you know, village healers and things like that who were seen as having this sort of secret knowledge being dangerous, but were also a necessary part of society. Then gave, well, possibly not gave rise to directly, but definitely were a part of this this sort of mythologized role of women in particular in society and in you know, in mythology. You know, you so often in fairy tales you have the kind of the wise woman in the woods sort of thing.
Yeah.
Who can be a figure who they sometimes they help you, sometimes they hurt you, sometimes they hurt you to help you, sometimes yeah. They have secret agendas that you are not privy to. They're very tricksy characters. I kind of love that personally.
It's interesting that like in modern media that is typically that's a masculine stereotype, right? Mm. Like the social fringe character who has hidden knowledge that may be helpful or may be dangerous, right? Sort of the mad scientist.
Yeah. Yeah, or like the wise mentor kind of character.
Yeah, right. It's some, you know, is the red string corkboard character, yeah. Right? Like that's the kind of fringy, like, provider of hidden knowledge in modern media. But it's a similar role. This idea that the people, they're not completely outside society. They're kind of, they're right on the very edge. And of course, things that are, I have to say it, liminal.
Yes. I love the word liminal. You can use that. It's great. I love it.
It's kind of a, like a, it's just, it's maybe an overused term, but I feel like it's highly relevant here, you know, because these are characters who exist. Like, Melusine is clearly a queen properly understood. And, like, you know, because it would be inappropriate otherwise, she is a real princess. Mm. So she has this place in society, except with this one exception, you know, sort of except for one day a week, which makes you think a little bit of something like a, you know, a werewolf where they're a normal person most of the time.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that, but there's this one secret side. And I think that one of the reasons that these monsters are so powerful is that that's a symbol that can stand in for a lot of different relationships.
Yeah. And I think as well, the sites that they're found in are often things like forests, lakes, mountains. They are these spaces that are a part of the landscape and are often sort of almost like partially tamed, but they also act as in-between spaces that often pass between worlds, you know, lakes and rivers associated with the underworld and everything like that, forests with fae.
Raymond encounters Melusine while he's out hunting.
Yes.
Which is that's how you meet fairies.
Yeah, that's the number one pickup spot for fairies, apparently, in everything.
Because it's a hyper-civilized activity that takes place in the wilderness. And you know, this, boy, we're running out of time, but this just occurred to me, which is, of course, that, like, high medieval society is a society where privacy is extremely rare.
Yes, yeah.
But it's getting more common.
The private space was one of those things that was a big shift from what I recall. I haven't done a huge amount of research into it, but, you know, the idea of you were sort of always on display, and also there were always servants around in every private space in the house. And but then that, like you say, that was becoming more common, that people were starting to sort of ring fence their private spaces versus their public spaces. And in the act of doing that, they were making a private life versus a public life.
Yeah. And if you look at, for example, like high status architecture in the high Middle Ages, as it becomes increasingly complex, there are these kind of like ever decreasing circles of privacy until you finally get to like the chamber, this creation of an intimate private space. But so for us, the idea of like, oh yeah, she doesn't want to be disturbed while she's in the bath. What's weird about that? But it's stranger for an aristocratic woman in the high Middle Ages who might almost never be meaningfully alone.
Yes.
You know, who wouldn't be alone when she was asleep? Who wouldn't, you know, bathing was a public activity. You know, who would maybe be alone when she was like on the toilet? It would maybe be the one time that she would be really alone, and sometimes not even then. So the idea of aloneness as suspicious is maybe something that stands out more.
I think that's actually a really interesting point, especially where it crosses over with the idea of communities of women.
Mm.
Because that was a time when you weren't alone, but there wasn't a male sort of supervision. And so that sort of space was theoretically safe. You know, it was theoretically a place where, you know, people weren't getting up to anything really awful, but what are they really talking about? Are they talking about us? Are they, you know, are they plotting? Are they sharing secret knowledge? And they were doing things like sharing knowledge of contraceptives and, you know,
or even just talking about their opinions of, you know, people who weren't there, right? I mean, even today, with it, I think people still have that same anxiety.
Yeah.
And you see this with discussions of sort of gendered spaces, the, you know, not to go into too much depth with it, but that conversation about quote unquote locker room talk.
Yes. Yeah.
Where I'm like, I've been in a lot of locker rooms. Like, and the conversations aren't like that, but they are different.
Mm.
You know, it is true. Anyone who says that they don't have some degree of curiosity about what gets said in those spaces, probably not being completely honest. I mean, I think, you know, what do communities, and not just in terms of gender, but although that's the most obviously relevant here, but what do communities that I'm not part of talk about when I'm not there?
I think there's also a level of, I don't want to use this in like a sordid way, but like fantasizing about it, not as like a, just not in a specifically sexual way, but being like, this is like, we're making up this kind of idea of what's talked about there as bigger than it is, you know, as more salacious than it is, because it's interesting. It's fun to imagine. It's like, ooh, my.
But certainly, like, in terms of media, I would say that depictions by and for men of what goes on in women-only spaces are almost certain to be highly inaccurate.
Yeah, lots of pillow fights at sleepovers and things.
That's what you would like it to be.
Yes, basically.
And, which is what makes the weird element of the fact that the guy is spying on his wife, who he sees the other 6 days of the week.
Yeah.
And with whom he has had 10 children. You know, like, I don't know what he thinks she's hiding. I bet he didn't think it was snake legs. Though maybe after the kids, he'd hang on. Are you a fairy? Met her in the woods.
This is seeming suspicious now, suddenly.
Built my castle overnight using rocks she found. Now that I think about it, I guess there is a...
Hey, honey, look what I did.
Okay, that's about all the time that we have for Melusine, although I feel like still we've only scratched the surface, partly because she combines so many motifs that occur in other medieval monster stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, she's almost already kind of like a greatest hits of other themes. So we're just about out of time, but before we go, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about where they can find you online and about projects that you've got coming up?
So people can find my short role-playing games and interactive fiction at magpie-l.itch.io and my occasionally updated gaming culture and review blog at theanxiousgamer, all one word, .wordpress.com.
I'll put links to those down in the show notes.
So the next project I'm involved in is the second book from the Secret Frequency Files series on the ST Vaults, Storyteller's Vaults. It's a book of real-world myths, legends, and folk stories turned into game material for the Chronicle of Darkness game lines. It's basically a printed version of what the Darker Days radio show does for their podcast, and it's done by Darker Days Publishing. The team's really cool. It's got people from Darker Days Radio who also write for the Warhammer RPGs like Wrath and Glory and Age of Sigmar, Vampire and Third Eye Games. I'm writing about one of my absolute favourite East Anglian ghost stories, so I'm really excited about that. So I'm really looking forward to being able to put it out there into the world.
Great. And well, as always, I'm pleased to see East Anglian folklore get an outing. We have, in fact, this evening, well, the evening when we're recording this, I'm playing in a Swords and Wizardry game where one of the characters is a cleric of a deity based on a figure from East Anglian folklore.
Oh,
he's a cleric of Tom Hickathrift.
Amazing.
But fantastic, so we'll keep an eye out for that. So I guess that only leaves to thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been really great having you.
Well, thank you for a really fascinating discussion.
And with that, next week we'll be returning to our regularly scheduled interstitial episodes. And by regularly scheduled, I mean I'm making them up as I go along, and I haven't even thought of what they're going to be yet. And after that, we're going to see the beginning of Season 4, where we're going to start taking a look at the Creature Catalog, a supplement for basic Dungeons & Dragons that has some classic monsters and some distinct oddballs. All of it right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.